I bring you greetings this morning from Fellowship Congregational Church on South Harvard, my home church. It is a pleasure to worship in this beautiful space with you this morning. A place of prayer, a place of music, a place of incredible leadership. Thank you to all of you in your worship committee. I think I'm getting close to the microphone, right? Is this one? Yes, I think we're better. Microphones have always been the bane of my preaching career. I want to tell you about a parking lot moment I had this week. You know that time when you go to the jail and you can't go in because of the spellbinding NPR program on your radio? A parking lot moment. Take 10% of your time and force yourself to go places that are seemingly weird. Put yourself someplace to learn, to be curious, to discover. That was said by Beth Comstock. She was on the Commonwealth Club at 12 noon on Wednesdays last week. She's an American businesswoman and former vice president of GE. She was talking about business. I heard her talking about faith. Put yourself in weird spaces to hear stories, to encounter another point of view, she said. I heard, put yourself in weird spaces where you can hear the stories of the people of God. Weird places, new perspectives. She was describing the last 4 weeks of my life. First, there was Israel in Istanbul with 15 people representing Christian, Muslim, Jew, and nun, covered and uncovered, gay and straight, dining in the $100 million house of Al Jazeera fame. Then there was Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the Free Her Conference at the Marriott Hotel, Southern Hills, with about 300 passionate women, 90% women of color, two-thirds formerly incarcerated. Weird places, even my own car, as I listened to the drama of the United States Supreme Court hearings, which have culminated during October, Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Be curious, listen, new perspectives. It was a parking lot moment. All this at a time when your worship committee asked me to preach, and the lectionary said, Job. And because there was Israel, and because there were four friends covered and uncovered, now there was Ayub. Listen now to the readings from the Quran. Indeed, we have revealed to you, O Muhammad, as we revealed to Noah and the prophets after him. And we revealed to Abraham and Ishmael and Isaac and Jacob, the descendants, Jesus, Job, Jonah, Aaron, and Solomon. And to David we gave the book of Psalms. And remember our servant Job? When he called to his Lord, indeed, Satan has touched me with hardship and torment. So he was told, strike the ground with your foot. This is a spring for a cool bath and a drink. And we granted him his family and a like number with them as mercy from us and a reminder for those of understanding. We said, and take your hand, a bunch of grass, and strike with it, and do not break your oath. Indeed, we found him patient and an excellent servant. Indeed, he was one repeatedly turning back to Allah, to God. The stories of God for the people of God. Please pray with me. We love the house in which you dwell, O God, the place where your glory abides. Keep your steadfast love before our eyes as we walk in faithfulness to you. Amen. Sermon alert. You will hear little today about God, although the stories will be about the people of God. And we will not be exegeting the book of Job today. Today, Job is simply the text that starts us thinking about weird spaces in which to learn. Space in which to be curious and to ponder where God's people might lead us. Earlier, did you notice that Mike read our lectionary text from the Hebrew text called the Tanakh? With that reading, we pushed ourselves a bit into a new space. A new space, yes, yet if you were following along in your pew Bibles, there wasn't much difference between what you heard from the lectern and what you saw in your Bible. That's one lesson about weird places. Some places are not as uncomfortable and weird as we feared they might be. During these few minutes that we're going to talk about Job, there are a couple of things worth noting. Did you know that there are words in the book of Job that show up nowhere else in the Hebrew scriptures? That's weird. And did you know that some scholars believe that the book of Job was originally written in Aramaic, or perhaps in Arabic? I will hasten to add that other scholars have evidence that it was written in Hebrew, no doubt about it. It's another lesson of risking to step into weird places. Sometimes there's tension. Before we move on from Job, might I suggest that the next time your book club wants to wrestle with literary genius and the weighty topics of human suffering, faith, and God's steadfast love, choose the book of Job. It's an incredible read. As for our second reading, were you familiar with the story of Islam's Job, Ayub, before today? If not, you may feel as if you've slipped into a weird space. We are in Christian worship, listening to the story of Ayub from Islam. Why? Because our quest during this 10% of the day is to put ourselves in places to learn, to be curious, to discover. So the Quranic story goes like this. Let me give you the cliff notes. Job has credibility. He's named among the prophets. Job, or Ayub, as he's known, is in extreme distress. Ayub prays. God listens. Then God gives Ayub a plan for action. Do this and you'll get that. With God-given knowledge, Ayub now digs up a water fountain at the specific location and benefits from its healing powers. The lesson of Ayub, of Job, are clear. One, God's steadfast love is foundational and forever steadfast. Two, God will guide us in this earthly sojourn. Three, we have a choice as to whether or not we will put our trust in God and take the appropriate action. That's our choice. Job and Ayub. The same character, two names, two perspectives, one from the Hebrew text, one from the Quran. Both beautifully told, both equally engaging, both inspiring the faith of people for which the stories were written. How strange to encounter them here together in Christian worship. Hebrew. Muslim. And our search for weird places to listen to the stories of the people of God. We are now entering Israel's West Bank, a large area of the west of the Jordan River, contested by Jews and Arabs and under military rule. 2 Sundays ago, you heard stories from Pastor Todd about his trip to Israel. Bob and I were two of the 15 people on that trip with Pastor Todd. My guess is that your takeaway from Todd's Sunday morning jet lag sermon was, it's complicated. Yeah? And it is. There we were, 15 people called to the Holy Lands, or maybe called to the land of the holy, the land of Jews and Christians, Muslims, and even secular, to listen to two interpretations of one story. Dual narrative travel, they call it. Listening to stories. Travel designed to challenge participants to think on multiple levels. Our need was not that of clarity. Our goal was to listen, to increase our knowledge of conflicts, and to validate people's lived experiences. Our guides, Eldad, secular Israeli Jewish, and Adam, Jordanian Arab Palestinian and card-carrying Israeli citizen. They told us that in any story, there are facts. There are eliminated facts. There are things we're not sure about. And that putting together multiple stories gets us closer to what really happened. Good information. Going to Jerusalem was a weird stepping off place for all of us, even our guides, as it turned out. Early in the tour, we met with Rabbi Daniel Roth. Rabbi Roth is the director of Pardes Center for Judaism and Conflict Resolution. And he is leading an effort to resurrect an ancient holiday on the Jewish calendar, a day dedicated to resolving conflicts constructively and to actively pursuing peace. A calendar day. An idea worthy of considering, yes? Rabbi Roth is originally from Syracuse, New York, and he was reared in a conservative religious Zionist family. And my efforts at note-taking with Rabbi Roth, I lost track of the players in the Israeli story of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Religious Zionists, secular Zionists, the Knesset, ultra-Orthodox Jews, Messianic Jews, Messianic Zionists, anti-Zionists. Indeed, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is complicated with no clear road to peace. Finally, someone asked the question on all of our lips, if there was one thing you could do to address the conflict, what would you do? Rabbi Roth's response was immediate. I'd make Arabic mandatory in every school beginning in grade one. The next day, we visited such a school. Hand in Hand, a nonprofit bilingual school for Arab and Jewish youth in Israel, where elementary school classes are taught by co-teachers, one Jewish and one Arab, in which all students learn both Hebrew as well as Arabic. Arab Christians, Muslims, Armenian Christians, Druze, Mizrahi, Ashkenazi, and Ethiopian Jews, and a growing number of observant Jewish families as well, all were welcome, all seeking a new direction. A post on the Hand in Hand Facebook page says, if every school in Israel, the West Bank and Gaza was a hand-in-hand school, there would be no conflict. The spokesperson for hand-in-hand schools, Noah, told us that she, like Rabbi Roth, had grown up in a conservative, religious, Zionist family. Until she went to college, she had no contact nor exposure in this small place, the Palestinian youth. Then she found herself sharing a music stand with a Palestinian. And her fear and mistrust transformed into friendship. As Noah shared her story, and as we watched Israeli, Arab, Palestinian, Christian, Muslim, and Jewish children giggling in the courtyard and sharing tables in the classroom, our 6-foot guide fought back tears. Eldad was our guide into this dual narrative, yet he did not know this place called Hand in Hand. He did not know that his dream of peace could be glimpsed in his beloved Israel. Now he knew. It's an odd phenomenon to think you thoroughly know your craft and your environment, only to be transported into a space you didn't even know existed. Upon returning to Tulsa, I found myself at the National Free Her Conference, where about 300 women gathered to proclaim, "Free her." It didn't take long to realize that this space was different and that the term dual narrative had followed me back to Tulsa. My white, privileged American culture encountered in that place the mass incarceration of people of color, of people with mental illness, and of people seeking safety in this country. And although my white American culture proclaims that the U.S. abolished slavery in 1864, the women of Free Her know firsthand that slavery was never abolished and exists today, sometimes at working for 24 cents an hour in the prison complex, making Made in America products. Dual narratives. So I listened. The demands were clear in that place. No bonds, no debilitating fines and fees, no solitary confinement for anyone. Unlock the box, rang the slogan. No more sending re-entry people back to programs in the same neighborhoods that brought them into prison. Voting rights for all people released from prison, regardless of probation and parole status. No more slavery, no incarceration for women and girls. Free her. No incarceration for women and girls. No jails. That one made me curious. No incarceration. If not incarceration, then what? I know bad things happen. I heard the story from a woman who said that her son was arrested for murder on Friday. Her daughter was murdered on Saturday. Bad things happen. What about the consequences? What about justice? What about public safety? So as I sat around the table breaking bread at this conference, I asked the woman next to me what she thought about no incarceration. She said she was 52 years old. Her name is Teresa, and she said, "Share my story." "I was always the one telling people don't do drugs," she said. "Then my friend was struggling with cancer, and the drugs she had to take for the cancer were making her sicker than the disease. Crack eased the pain and complications caused by the cancer drugs. When she asked me if I could get her some crack, I said, 'I'll do anything for you, baby.' And since she was my friend, and since I lost track of my boundaries, I told her I'd smoke with her. It was the one thing I thought I could do to be with her in her pain. She told me not to do it. She begged me not to do it. Yet I loved her, and she was going through hard times. I believed that smoking with her wouldn't hurt me. I was 42 years old, and I was strong. I was wrong. Before long, I was forging checks to support my habit. Around that time, we moved from my family in New York City to South Carolina, and my husband was cheating on me. Someone called my mama in New York and told her I was doing drugs. That call was made at 8 o'clock in the morning. By 5 o'clock p.m., my mama was in my living room in South Carolina saying to someone, "You're a liar. My daughter would never do drugs. My daughter is always the one telling other people not to do drugs." I went to prison. Yes, the drugs were there too. Drugs are easy to get. So why did I not go looking for them? It was when I realized that I couldn't hold my husband, I couldn't hold my son, and I couldn't wipe my mama's tears as she sat on the other side of the visiting glass from me. When asked about no jails, Teresa said, "Maybe all we need is time for reflection and a safe place to do it." The final session of the conference was last Sunday about this time. We were all asked to make a pledge. Said the woman, "My number one purpose in life is to create safe space for Black people. So repeat after me," she said. "I commit myself to healing. I commit myself to Black people. I commit myself to honor the power I was born with. I commit myself to healing." And now I can't help but think of the Supreme Court hearings of the past 2 weeks and the statements of Judge Kavanaugh and Dr. Ford. Our entire culture stepped into weird spaces for the last 2 weeks. We now know that Dr. Ford's story did not change the outcome of an appointment to the Supreme Court for Judge Kavanaugh. Yet, we listened. The nation listened. And now we have no excuse for not knowing that the testimony made by Dr. Ford happens every day. And because Dr. Ford dared to speak and because she risked going into that new place, we will never be the same again. We are more likely to listen. And that's a good thing. Israel, free her Tulsa. The Supreme Court hearings. Take 10% of your time. Force yourself to go places that are seemingly weird. Put yourself someplace to learn, to be curious, to discover. Those weird spaces are the places we will find God's people. All God's people. And thinking about these past 30 days, the weirdest space I could dare to go is this table. Imagine, all around the world, from all kinds of denominations, God's people will come to a table on this day to partake in the sacrament and remember other Christians around the world. The practice began at Shadyside Presbyterian Church in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1933. Yet this ancient table says all are welcome. From north and south, from east and west, they will gather. God's people called to the table where heaven meets earth, where simple grace nourishes. There's really no other place like it on earth, quite like this dream of the table of plenty. Can this be a space where we dare to truly meet one another, where we will break bread together, where we will share a cup, where we will listen to the stories of the people of God, no violence, no conflicts, no prior allegiances that force us apart, all races, all colors, all genders, all abilities and disabilities, praying, talking to one another, feasting, dancing, and gathering with saints and sinners, believing in the covenant that all people, all are welcome. It's a weird dream. May we make it so.